call the docket.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Allison Carpenter, arguing on behalf of Mr. Umania Barrera. At issue in this case is whether a nunk-pro-tunk order that the trial court entered about a year after the original orders is valid, given the evidence that would be on the record or on the quasi-record under the case law. Our position is that through the case law, such as Davis v. Mullins, Harris v. Commonwealth, and like cases, that the judge did indeed enter a valid nunk-pro-tunk order, allowing him to suspend the execution of the judgment that he had originally entered in January of 2013.
Counsel, may I interrupt? When you say given the evidence, the only evidence that's relevant in nunk-pro-tunk is did the court previously make a ruling that was somehow not properly recorded on an order? It's not could he have or she have, or were they thinking about it, or whether or not it would have been the appropriate thing to do, but rather did it in fact happen?
Correct. And to that, I refer you to page 131 of the record, which is the transcript in issue. It is the April 15th, 2013 transcript. The parties came before the court. Apparently the court, the way the transcript goes, there was a misunderstanding. The court thought the parties had been notified that there was to be an evidentiary hearing that day. Neither the Commonwealth nor defense counsel had received that notice. And so the parties agreed to continue the case to another date. But on page 131, Mr. Leyva, who was the defense counsel at that point, says, where the court says, let's set a date then to do this, you need a month out. Mr. Leyva says, that would be fine, Your Honor. Of course, I would need another order. And the court says, yes.
Well, an order continuing a case is not the same thing as an order suspending a final judgment.
Correct, but what Mr. Leyva was asking for was the other suspension order. And so, of course, in retrospect, it would have been far better had he just said, I would need another suspending order.
This is a complicated narrative, but am I right that one point that you just made is the dispositive point? If that exchange that you just reported is not construed to be a judicial act of suspending a final judgment in a criminal case, that's not the proper interpretation, then the Court of Appeals was clearly right. If it is a better interpretation as you present it, then there's a whole other subject we have to get to.
That's correct. However, what I would point out is based on the information allowed for us to look into it under Harris and Counsel v. Commonwealth in particular, there's quasi-record evidence allowed. And I think this is distinguishable from Davis v. Mullins, for example, where the parties... Davis v. Mullins is a case where there was a correct order entered. And in our case, the nunk-pro-tunk order that was entered a year later was correctly entered. And that's in contrast to Superfresh, wherein they did not enter a correct order because they did not have the power to retain jurisdiction, and by using the language they did, which is that this court will retain jurisdiction, that did not invoke a power that they actually had.
Counsel, can we talk for a second about the practicalities of how these things happen? Certainly, a lot of the cases we have on this point are civil cases, and in civil cases, the attorneys are responsible for drafting orders and having them entered by the judge, and obviously responsible for making sure that they contain what they need to contain. It's a lot different in a criminal case, isn't it? Because the courtroom clerks usually prepare the order. A lot of times they use form orders. Counsel are not ordinarily involved in the cases. And so we look at the judge to have him interpret his own order and understand what he meant. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. And in this particular case, the order that was entered was a form order. And a note on the form order, there was no box. There were boxes that were checked off that the clerk filled in and then had the judge sign. There was no box that said order suspended or anything like that. So as far as ministerial role goes, the clerk would not have been alerted that he or she needed to look into whether...
And when this judge went back to interpret his order to decide whether he could enter a nunk-pro-tunk order, he knew, I believe, that implicit in this entire situation was his intent to have this case continued and the order suspended, the final order suspended, so he could make a ruling on the defense motion, wasn't it?
That's correct. And we do have the information from page 131 here, which I believe is the judicial action that was actually in the record, in contrast to all the cases in which there was no timely action taken whatsoever. This was action taken within the 21-day period that the order remained within the jurisdiction of the court. But once you look at the course of conduct, for example, over from January until really June, you have the defense counsel and the prosecutor coming to court on numerous occasions asking the judge for the suspending order. The judge or another judge in circuit court was regularly...
Well, why would he need to ask for a suspension order? That's always implied whenever you continue a case, and the clerk's responsible for getting it right. What's the point of the lawyer being there if the lawyer's not going to advocate for what the client needs?
Well, there does need to be an action taken in order for the case law regarding non-protunct orders or correct orders to be entered. Defense counsel does need to ensure that the order remains open, and of course the judge is
responsible. But are you saying in a criminal case, every time a defense attorney asks for a continuance of a post-final judgment matter, that implicit in that is a matter of law is a request for a suspension of the 21 days or tolling of it or whatever you want to call it until then? Because that would be new law if we were to say that.
My reading of the record is not that Mr. Leyva was asking for another... When he says another order, he's not referring to the continuance motion. Another order means something separate, which is the suspension order. And in the prior transcripts, I believe there were two February transcripts.
Well, an order was entered. April 22, an order was entered. And it was a continuance order. It wasn't a suspension order.
That's correct. But when he says, I would need another order, and the court says yes, based on the course of conduct...
In fact, counsel, the defense attorney doesn't usually ask for a continuance order. That's up to the court to do it. If the judge says, I'll continue your case, the defense attorney doesn't have to go prepare the order because the clerk does that.
That's correct.
I think what happened in this case, or maybe I'll ask you this question, does the record reflect what happened in this case? Is that this attorney was trying to make it very careful that the suspended order was entered. That's what he was talking about.
Yes, I believe that's correct. And I think also some deference to the judge and to the parties at this point is in order. For example, when we're looking at sufficiency of the evidence cases, we're deferring to the fact finder because they saw the credibility, they observed the witnesses. And what we don't have on a black and white record is whether there was some sort of laugh, for example, like, oh, we know we asked for this every time, or something like that. And so when the judge a year later entered the non-protunct order without hesitation, I believe we should also defer to his understanding of what was implied in this language.
A lot was implied because the conversation that the court had on April 15th only gets you to May 30. And the non-protunct order gets you beyond May 30 to June 6, which is when the denial order was entered, and then has a totally new 60-day extension. It seems like to me there's a lot of after-the-fact fixing something that was wrong when it was done initially.
Well, by having the ability to look back and knowing what day the court would render a decision, the court had the ability to sign 60 days into effect because the judge knew that's what would be necessary. However, given the fact that they set this for May 30th, the fact that even in this record, the judge is issuing decisions and then signing orders maybe 1, 2, 3 weeks later, it would make sense that the judge would set it out past the date of the hearing, because at this point, this is the first time they have a specific hearing date where the parties and the judge all agree that it was a hearing date.
Counsel, let me ask you this. I shared Justice Kelsey's concern that we don't want to allow judges to just out of an act of grace enter an order that didn't reflect what really happened. But doesn't everything in this record reflect that this judge all along continued to have the intent to hear this motion, have it be one that could be appealed if that was the party's choice? And the course of conduct, as I think you mentioned before, reflects that this is an unusual situation where he's interpreting his own order to mean that he always intended to continue it.
Yes, I believe so. And I think this is in contrast to a lot of the cases. For example, in Davis, the non-protunct order was entered 10 years later. And there's absolutely zero evidence on the record that anyone tried to do it within the 21-day period. I don't think this offends the concepts of finality because all of the parties all along believed the case would become final when it did on our position on June 6th, when the judge entered the order plus the 21 days. And so finality isn't offended here. No one's trying to come back later to reopen a case. The issue is not whether it became final. The issue is when it became final. Did it become final in April? Did it become final in June? And in this particular case, the
judge... Maybe it became final on May 30.
Or May 30.
I mean, so we have several tiers of grace here. We have giving him a suspension on top of a continuance, and then moving the suspension beyond the date that was mentioned, which was May 30, to cover June 6, which was never mentioned.
Well, the judge was not, on the earlier orders in the case, the judge was not setting an expiration date. Rather, there were several different orders that were signed. There was a 30-day suspension, there was a 10-day suspension, there was another 30-day. And so it's consistent with what the judges were doing, which was to continue this past the time that they would need in order to make a decision. And so having had an April 15th hearing, having it go to May 30th for the evidentiary hearing is about 6 weeks. And the judge, of course, would have needed time to render a decision afterwards, given that his course of conduct...
But all of his prior suspension orders had a deadline on it. The deadline worked out to April 30. They weren't open-ended suspension orders, which he could have done, but he didn't.
Well, the suspension orders did not set... That's correct. He could have just done an open suspension. It appears that this judge's course or general behavior is not to just do an open-ended suspension.
Well, counsel, let me ask you this. The judge is a brand-new circuit court judge. I think he just come on the bench right before this happened.
The judge...
I know he doesn't do that this way now.
The judge had just come on the bench, I believe, on July 1st of 2012. So this was, of course, looking, this is the September plea of 2012. It was one of the
first cases. Does the law change courtroom to courtroom, judge to judge? You walk into one courtroom and you got a new judge and the law is different there because something completely irrelevant to the principle of law. You go into a courtroom with a senior, experienced judge, is the answer that no, he or she is expected to know more? That's, whatever that is, that's not law.
But the understanding based on different courtrooms can be different. For example, in Arlington, when the parties say, of course I would need another order, everyone may understand that, of course, that doesn't mean a continuance order because no one specifically asks for that. And so when you say, of course I would need another order, it's really an informal way of saying, Your Honor, I move for you to suspend this past the date of the hearing and for the time that you would need to render a decision.
And we do give deference to a judge to understand his own orders, don't we?
That's correct. And then the judge is saying yes was, I grant your motion to suspend this case further. And I think that the case law in this matter, for example, in Superfresh, we have an order that was entered timely but was not entered correctly. And so I don't think that that's an analogous situation here, because the issue in Superfresh was really that the court writing shall retain jurisdiction, it did not grant itself a power that it actually had. Whereas, for example, in Davis v. Mullins, the order was entered correctly but not timely. And unfortunately, when they looked back at the record, despite the fact that they had all been acting that way for 10 years, there was no evidence that anyone had taken an action within 21 days, in contrast to this.
If I may interrupt again, I think I got your point a second ago, which is, in some courtrooms, perhaps this one, perhaps with a brand new judge, you don't have to ask for a continuance motion. And he doesn't have to enter a continuance motion because it's sort of assumed. At least that's what I think you're sort of saying. So therefore, if you ask for anything like that, you must necessarily be asking for a suspension order. Well, the problem here is the order that was entered on April 22 following the April 15 hearing with a May 30 deadline is a continuous order. It is ordered that this case is continued. So whatever this judge's understanding of way things happen or shouldn't happen, what he did was enter a continuous order to May 30.
And in contrast to the earlier orders that were signed by the judge and typed, this one was a form order that was clearly written by the clerk.
So now the principle law changes because it's a form order? At what point do we just not apply the law as it is?
Well, I think based on this case where there was an action taken on the record, which is the page 131 that I point out, and where the judge a year later did enter that nunk-pro-tunk order stating that that is what he granted the year before, I think we have record evidence showing that the judge had intended to take that action and that he had done so in a timely manner.
Our case law makes it pretty clear that the use of a nunk-pro-tunk order is to correct what happened, not to create something new. You can't reacquire jurisdiction, for example, with a nunk-pro-tunk order. What you're doing is you're as a judge is saying, this is what happened back then. The order doesn't reflect what happened back then. Let's enter this order and reflect what happened back then. So it's not a matter of reacquiring jurisdiction. It's a matter of clarifying what the court did when it had jurisdiction. You would agree with that?
Yes, I agree with that.
And so when you look in this, it seems to me this entire case comes down to two lines. The lawyer, the court's talking about the dates and things. The lawyer says, of course I would need another order. And the court says, yes. That's this entire case right here. What are they talking about? And you're saying that we should look to the practices and behavior in Arlington County. That must have meant a suspension. I'm not sure that we can do that. I think we look to the actual colloquy. If the judge said, for example, or the lawyer said, I would need another suspension order, and the judge said yes, it seems to me that's a ruling of what actually happened, and that we wouldn't be here, because the non-pro-tunk order would be reflecting what actually happened. But it seems to me this entire case rests on, of course I would need another order, answer yes. You agree with that?
I agree that that is the dispositive language in it. I don't think we need to look at all of Arlington County. I think in this particular case, we do have the record in this case, and we do have the party's course of action. Also, the Commonwealth never objected and did agree throughout the entire course of this, the post-trial proceedings and...
But suppose I need another order means I need a continuance order. And that's what they got, was a continuance order rather than a suspension.
Well, the judge, though, a year later, did enter the order in the nunk-pro-tunk capacity, saying that, essentially, he had granted the suspension order a year before. And so
that's why I say, did he? And I looked at, I would need another order. Answer, yes. Can we interpolate from that that's a suspension order rather than the continuance order that he actually got?
I believe so. I think there is an actual action taken. That's the action taken was, I would need another order. I believe another order implies that it is not a continuance order. It is another order based on the language.
Well, you know, there's somebody somewhere along the line said that hard cases make bad law. I if I were to look at this record and say, what was he talking about? I'm probably about 90% sure he's talking about a suspension order. He's an experienced lawyer. The judge knows what he's talking about. But I am concerned about what this means if you cite this case in the future for the proposition that you can be that vague and retain jurisdiction.
Well, I think the standard is clear and convincing, and so under the clear and convincing standard, I think that meets the level of it.
Okay. Well, thank you. I think we know your position.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Donald Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth this morning.
Counsel, I don't mean to, I hate to do this, to ask your question about that, but I didn't want to have the colloquy with Justice Lemons without having somebody be the go-between. Isn't the one person who would know what that word yes means the judge? Wouldn't he be the one that would know what he meant when he said yes, whether he meant a suspending order or just a continuous order?
What we normally have, Your Honor, and obviously in response to your question, there obviously is a body of law that talks about courts interpreting their own orders. But I think the overlay here in this context is the standard that we apply to this. It has to be clear and convincing, has to be unequivocal. Counsel actually uses the term beyond all doubt. And frankly, the only reason I didn't put that in my brief was because I think there's an argument that that phrase is actually higher standard than clear and convincing, which, as the court knows, is a very high standard. And I think that's the crux of what you have here. I mean, pretty much the dialogue that's occurred already has laid out all the salient facts and counterarguments. And
well, let me go to the policy idea, I guess, maybe.
Okay.
I think the policy is probably we don't want judges to do things that they didn't already do, just out of an act of grace.
Correct.
And I accept that fully. I don't want a judge to 2 years later say, well, boy, I wish I had given that guy some different relief. I didn't do it, but I'll just go back and do it now. And judges can't do that. But if this judge interpreted what happened to be consistent with his plan all along to keep continuing the case and suspending the order so that he could make a final ruling that would be appealable, isn't that consistent with the way he handled this case?
I think it may be consistent with what he did in the past, but there's language in the case law that talks about what he might have done, or if it would have been a good idea. I think
what he did on this particular case.
Well, I think, I'm sorry.
I mean, why would it make any sense for him to have suspended the order all along, and then when he finally got up to almost to the day of having the decision. Well, no, I'm not going to suspend the order now. Well, I know that sometimes we're concerned about a final order becoming final when, if we would allow somebody to file a motion to set aside the verdict, does it then start from the denial of that? We've said no.
Correct. Well,
correct. And that makes sense. But this case, all along, I believe, if you have a fair reading of the record, this judge always intended to make a ruling on that motion and have that ruling be subject to appeal. And the Commonwealth, I think, accepted that position.
And I think that this court's case law is consistent with the parties may have intended it, the court might have even intended it. The focus in this case has to be, the ultimate crux of this case is, what actually occurred on April 15th.
Even if it's a gotcha. Even Judge, you screwed up, so it's a gotcha. I know what you intended to do. I know you said yes to an order, but guess what? You didn't say it well enough, so we're going to say you didn't enter a suspending order.
Well,
what's the judicial benefit? What's the benefit to the law of having that holding in this case?
The concepts of finality, I think that's one benefit. I think
maybe it will provoke criminal defense lawyers to start reading orders that judges enter in their cases. Wouldn't that be a good idea?
And I think responsive to both what you're saying, Justice Kelsey, and what Justice Millett said, this question came up, Justice Lemons may be the only one who was on the court. I think he was the one asking the questions, and it was actually a lot less of a time frame. This is the same question that you asked, Justice Millett, which is, we all know the prevailing standard is that unlike civil cases, criminal defense lawyers or prosecutors don't generally.
And that's the practicality. Criminal defense lawyers, they don't look at the file if an order is going to continue because they don't care. They just want the date.
Yeah, except that doesn't, and in the context it came up with, this case is unpublished, so I'm only talking in terms of broad generalities. There was a lot more slack time here. And, you know, you're playing with fire, especially when you have multiple suspension orders. I mean, this lawyer was on notice more than any other lawyer I can think of, and in fact, did this correctly. You look at this record, this lawyer knew how to do this, knew that he had to be watching behind this. He drafted orders that I would take some issue with this 30 days, and you've got all the overlapping
stuff.
That
is a mess, yeah.
But the part about this suspense, that was crystal clear. He knew how to do this. He was on notice. He had to watch it. And unlike the case I was talking about where Justice Lemons and I had this dialogue, that lawyer had a 3-day window. Yeah, I'd suggest to you this lawyer had essentially a 28-day window from the end of the April 15th hearing. The order was entered a week later, and then he had 21 days to kind of stay behind it and make sure it was done correctly, or just ask the court, look, let me do this, Judge. Remember, he had a cooperative prosecutor. He had a cooperative judge. I think the prosecutor, all the prior orders were signed, I think, essentially seen and agreed by the Commonwealth's Attorney's office. There's a way to do this, and I think
this wasn't even argued in the Court of Appeals, if I understand. The Attorney General didn't even take this position in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals brought it up.
We weren't counsel of record at that point.
Oh, okay.
I don't believe the Commonwealth's Attorney argued that point. I think it was sua sponte.
Yeah.
It was brought up at the panel level, but you're on notice that you've got to do it, and I think the...
Well, the Court of Appeals granted leave for the non-protonque to be considered, so that it's not that the court ambushed anybody. They actually gave the trial judge an opportunity to state his or her case.
Correct. It was raised... What actually happened, Justice Kelsey, is that there was a one-judge order that found a 1:1 problem. Defense counsel came back in and said the court ought to have a chance to fix this. The court's granted leave. It went back, and that's why we had the non-protonque orders we do now. So,
can I ask one last question?
Sure.
One thing I don't quite understand, even in the debate we've already had, is, as I understand the appellant's position, I don't see how that gets her past May 30. Because all of these suspension orders are date-specific orders. You know, you got 30 days, you got until X date. So the whole dialogue that we're creating this implied suspension from, whereas it's been expressed up to that moment, would only get them to May 30, and the order we're talking about is June 6. Why isn't that a second tier of problems analytics?
It is, and the court probably is aware that we did argue that as well. And I'm relying on the language of Rule 1:1 that essentially what you've got is 21 days, and it has the language "and no longer." And there was that interim 21-day period. Of course, that was extended. But I don't, and I will say, because I do need to follow up, I don't think the plain language of that rule connotes you get another 21 after the 21, or even the 14. Like, say this had happened at day 14, give you 30 days. okay, essentially, you know, 30 days, that takes you out to whatever, day 44. But you don't get another 21. I will tell you, Justice Kelsey, it's a case of first impression, but I would also say that with the principles of finality, that is our analysis of it, that once that suspension is granted to a point outside the 21-day period, you don't get another 21-day period.
Clearly, counsel, this is not this order. These orders are not models of clarity, and probably it's a good example of how not to do this. But isn't it also true, in response to that May 30th argument that Justice Kelsey is asking you to respond to, that all the previous orders did not suspend the final order till the day of the continuance. They suspended off for all these different periods of time. They kept adding 14 days here and 21 days here, and it was very confusing as to what they really were doing. But they did not, just because they set a continuous date, they didn't set the suspension date to that date, the same date, did they?
That's the cap date. That's the only date that was ever mentioned, was May 30th. I mean, obviously the court knows, and I said this in my brief, we don't think it was suspended at all, but the outside date for action was May the 30th. Now, I do think that I need to tell you, in fairness, and I didn't pick up on this until I was preparing for this argument, there is, I believe it's dicta, but there is a suggestion in two of this court's cases, Super Fresh Food Markets versus Ruffin, and this is going to be at 263 Virginia, 563 to 564, and then there's an opinion, Hutchins versus Talbert, and that's at 278 Virginia. The pinpoint is at 654 to 655. I think a reasonable person looking at that could arguably think that that's binding authority that says that we're wrong on this point. What I would suggest to you is that it's dicta, that really what those cases were about were notices of appeal.
Can you talk about this point? Is that the 21-day point? Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. Only on the point that Justice Kelsey, the last point he made, which is essentially, do you get any time beyond May 30th? And the court has suggested twice that the answer would be yes, which is why I feel like I have
21 days from the end of the suspension period.
Correct, Your Honor.
I think, are you familiar with Wagner, counsel? Because on that point, Wagner is more troubling to me than either Super Fresh or Hutchins, and it seems to me that Wagner is this case where there was an extension under Rule 1:1. It was a 30-day extension. The 30 days ran. And you may say it's dicta, but there is a footnote which would tend to indicate that there was an additional 21 days even after the 30-day extension, which would be consistent with the readings in Super Fresh and Hutchins.
Wagner also has the footnote. The only point, and again, I wish I had picked up on it when I wrote the brief that those things were there. I think I saw the footnote, but it seemed to me to be, throwaway is not the term that I'm looking for, but that issue was not decided in Wagner, because if the court recalls, everything that happened was done outside the 21 days. So I don't believe, and I think that's consistent with what I told the court earlier, this is ultimately an issue of first impression in terms of whether you get that additional 21 in this scenario. Because I don't think the court's ever decided that in any of these cases, and I don't think it was decided in Wagner. I think, Justice Powell, if you look at the timelines in Wagner, I gave that a very good look
yesterday. I did. I've got them all added up on the side.
The issue before the court wasn't this happened inside that extra 21 days. It's everything that happened.
But the footnote says the court also did not enter an order to continue the stay during the 21 days after the stay ended, which would indicate the court gave them a 30-day stay. They got an additional 21 days under Rule 1:1.
I can only really respond the way I already have, Your Honor, which is that wasn't an issue this court was ultimately asked to decide because of the facts of the case. It has never been decided, and I would suggest that given the principles of finality, you've got that initial 21, and it was suspended for quite a while.
But we'll have to decide that issue if we were to hold that the continuance was a de facto suspension.
And that would be the only reason that you would have to decide with Justice Kelsey. Otherwise, it's an issue you don't need to reach because they're two separate jurisdictional arguments. But yes, if the court agrees with the Court of Appeals, I mean, just to be clear, because I don't want it to get confusing, that really becomes a non-issue because that's a separate piece of the argument at that point. And that's really where we are with the default on that. If the court would like, I didn't spend a lot of time writing why I thought it was dicta. I'd certainly be glad to provide a written pleading or try to talk about that some more. But the nutshell version is that it wasn't the issue actually before the court. And I think that you have to remember that you were talking about, ultimately the cases were about notices of appeal and when counsel can, how counsel can predict when those have to be filed versus the principles of finality that are at issue with Rule 1:1. So I think they're different issues.
Mr. Jeffries, would
yes,
the
sir.
Wording of this particular court's orders have any impact on that 21-day rule? The court specifically says this order tolls the running of the 21-day provision, allowing 51 days, and gives some very specific numbers, for the entry of a final sentencing order. So at least with regard to the first order, he actually said, basically he said, I'm tolling this for 51 days.
Correct.
For a final order. So on that 51st day, would they then get another 21 because the final order doesn't enter into the 51st day?
Well, I think, as I understood the order, it was basically saying that it was entered on day 21. I'm extending it 30 more days, which means there's an aggregate of 51 when you consider the entire expanse. That's the way I read that order.
But his language for the entry of the final sentencing order, usually when the order is finally entered, that's when 1:1 kicks in. For the entry of a final sentencing order is the language of that, of the order.
Really closely to that, Your Honor, just to make sure. That one's on page 10, I think, of the appendix.
Yes. So the running.
I think the only response that I can give you was probably suggested by what I said earlier, Justice Powell, which is that ultimately that we went way past that 51 days, and the other orders that didn't have that type of language superseded that provision. I think that's really where we are with that. That would be our response to that. Because that there wasn't any language akin to that anywhere else. Basically, the court gave 30, and it was on top of the 21. But remember, that day was entered on the 21st day. So I think that's where, that's how we've always read that order. And I guess the short answer is that we don't think that does anything to create an additional 21 by operation of the law of the case. I think that's where you're headed with that. That ultimately we went way past those 51 days and kind of bound by the orders that happened.
Mr. Jeffrey, at the risk of becoming far too metaphysical, you ask yourself, how do you know something? How do you know? And when we're looking for meaning in statutes and how we know things, we actually use a construct. We look at text, and if that doesn't get us there, we look at context.
Okay.
And the Commonwealth has been at that podium many, many, many times, saying, all right, you want to know what that means? We look at the text. If that doesn't get it, we go to the context. The context of this case is that every time the lawyer asked for a continuance, he also asked for a suspension. And that pattern repeated itself. Well, why wouldn't that dynamic be the way we would interpret this case? Of course, I would need another order, and the court says yes. If every time that was done before, it was a continuance and a suspension, why isn't the right way to deal with this is to rely upon the trial judge to interpret his own act in the light of the behavior that has gone on time after time after time in this case? What's wrong with that?
The problem, well, multiple problems. I think one is that you do end up engaging in this sort of ad hoc examination of the record where it's not clear. It has to be clear and convincing. And you have to examine that, I think, against the backdrop that the ultimate written order that was entered didn't have that in it.
Does it have to be clear and convincing in form, or does it have to be clear and convincing in substance? I mean, I was a trial judge. Many of my colleagues were trial judges. And we know in the course of the trial many things are unspoken, but we know what they mean. We were there. Every time there was a continuance, there was a suspension order. And the lawyer comes up and says, I'd need another order. I know what that means. It means the same thing the last time, and the time before that, and the time before that. And so the trial judge comes back and he says, nunc pro tunc, I'm not going to change what I meant. What I meant is everything I did every time, continuance, suspension. I guess what I'm saying is, in this case, are we going to decide it with form over substance?
Again, I don't believe so, and I think there's a broader policy that this type of ad hoc examination, that this court has to have some certainty in looking at these things, that this actually happened, and the record just falls short of that. I think I keep coming back to the standard.
I guess that's a dilemma. If you want to just look at the words, you have no certainty it happened. If you want to engage in metaphysics of some sort, the art of epistemology, perhaps, we'll even get into realms that we can't imagine. I think I know what happened. So what do I do? I think I know what happened. I think I know what that judge meant. And he came back and said, this is what I meant. And it happens to be consistent with what I think he meant. Do I get to do that, or am I stuck? I would need another order. I'm sorry, he didn't say another order of suspension. You're out.
Except that, as Justice Kelsey pointed out in earlier questioning, one of the things that he says that he meant was another 60 days. There's nothing in there. There's nothing in there, and there are broader principles in terms of the way this court handles finality in cases and the types of ad hoc examination that are being done in this type of case. It's a bigger issue here. And I understand what you're saying, because I think that, again, your case law talks about the fact that he may have intended to do it, or it would have been a good idea. That's not governing, and that's not dispositive, and that's really at the crux of this case. And the next case that comes along, as Justice Kelsey pointed out, you start fashioning those kind of ad hoc rules like that. That's a slippery slope.
Fortunately, I am confident that my colleagues know what both sides think of this case. And soon you'll know what we think of
it. And I'm way past time where I can argue the merits, but that's in my brief, and I appreciate the court's time and indulgence for 4 extra minutes, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you for your argument. Call the next case.